Today's guest is Martin D. Lant. He is an award-winning journalist and a licensed private investigator specializing in wrongful convictions. He has a full-service investigations agency, ACE Investigations of Ohio, and has written extensively with his book Presumed Guilty being named by the Washington Post as one of the 8 most important books on miscarriages of justice ever published. His investigations have been featured in Time Magazine, The New York Times, and has been highlighted on 48 Hours, Dateline, Unsolved Mysteries, and the cable network channels of CNN and the Discovery Channel. He's also been on the Canadian broadcast system. I welcome Martin D. Lant to the show. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, Marty. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're with me today. And how are things in beautiful Columbus, Ohio today?
It's a beautiful early fall day. We're going to be in the mid-80s, and it's very sunny. And as I look out from my 18th floor office, I see the trees are starting to change color, which is delightful. So everything's pretty nice here.
Well, that's nice to hear. Here in Connecticut, where I hail from, we've had a gloomy, dark day today. It started out just gloomy, and now it's drizzling to add to the evening rush hour. As we speak, it's Monday, October the 8th, 2018. Normally, we do this on Fridays, but I had a little problem Friday with late appointments, and you were gracious enough to allow us to do this on Monday. So Columbus Day Monday. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much. So Marty, when people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
I tell them that I'm a licensed private investigator who specializes in investigating possible wrongful convictions. So that's the basic, although I have a full service agency and several other investigators, but I like to spend most of my time on investigating criminal cases or possible wrongful conviction cases.
And at this time, I can say it's ACE Investigations, a full service private investigation agency.
Right.
Okay. So now, Marty, I know that you've been doing this for a long time, but before this, you started as an investigative journalist. And can you tell me a little bit of how you got started there and then tell me a little later how you got started as a private investigator?
Well, my first inspiration for investigative journalism came from my uncle, who was an ACE investigative reporter for the Pittsburgh Press. And when I was just a little boy, there was a TV show called Front Page Detective that was a fictionalized version of something that an investigative reporter had done. And I just remember being thrilled because my uncle's case was featured in one of those shows.
No kidding.
So that kind of made me think that investigative reporting was pretty cool, even when I was just like 4 or 5 years old. So that was always in the back of my mind. And then when I was about 10 years old, I discovered Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. which is still a major literary passion of mine.
Okay.
And so I was always intrigued with investigation. I did some of that in Pittsburgh myself, and then later in Chicago in the 70s. But it all came to fruition when I became editor of the newspaper in Mansfield, Ohio, and in 1978, 40 years ago. And as soon as I arrived there, people started calling me and coming in to see me to tell me about horrible things going on in the local sheriff's department, including corruption, beatings, planting drugs, all kinds of things. So I initiated an investigation there that eventually ended up with the sheriff and 7 of his deputies being convicted.
Oh, my.
So that kind of really really attracted my interest. And it was that time, one of the lesser things that this sheriff did is that I wrote about was that he heard that this one person was thinking of running against him. So he had him framed to eliminate him as a potential opponent. So that really wasn't a serious offense. It was actually just, a first degree misdemeanor, but it certainly took that man out of the running for sheriff.
Now, did that man serve any prison time for that frame?
Pardon?
Did that man serve any prison time for that frame up?
No, he actually got probation.
Yeah, but still, he had an arrest record, and here he was running for sheriff, and now he's been disgraced by a frame from his competitor.
Yeah, ironically, the sheriff ended up with an arrest record, and when he got out of jail, he ran for sheriff again anyway. So, fortunately, he didn't win.
Oh, my. Yeah, I mean, we've heard of that with other mayors around the world, around the country, I should say, that have been arrested and convicted or arrested and pled guilty and then go back and get reelected again for their jobs. So, So you were an investigative reporter or editor there in Mansfield, Ohio. Any more things that you'd like to talk about in terms of learning the craft of investigation while you were a journalist and any mentors that were important to you?
Well, I had some good mentors in Pittsburgh and then particularly good mentors in Chicago, which when I arrived there in 1972 was still had four highly competitive newspapers. Now it's down to two.
Mm-hmm.
But so investigative reporting was a really big thing in Chicago. So I was involved in some of that, mostly as an editor working with the reporters to put the stories together. But I did learn a lot from them, some of whom had won or eventually won Pulitzer Prizes. So I got to see some real masters of the art of investigative reporting. So that really stuck with me, and then I was able to use those skills when I exposed this to Sheriff's Department and also the coroner and the prosecutor and some other major business people. The town was very corrupt, and that eventually ended up in a book I wrote later called Rotten to the Core.
Wow.
And Crime, Sex, and Corruption in Johnny Appleseed's Hometown. So I eventually moved on and ended up being an editor and a columnist at the Columbus Dispatch in the capital city of Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And my interest in wrongful convictions, which had been piqued by, you know, what I saw in Mansfield, caused me to continue to be interested in that. And I would occasionally write a column about how wrongful convictions occur. And that eventually evolved into another book called Presumed Guilty, When Innocent People Are Wrongly Convicted.
Yes. And that was published in 1991, right?
Correct. And at that point, I was swamped with people begging me to look into a loved one's case, to the point that I decided to leave the Dispatch and become a private investigator to investigate these cases.
So that was a life decision, obviously, one that you were able to follow your passion and be able to make the move. But then there also was the thinking of the financial and how was I going to make this happen? What was I going to do? So if you could just tell me a little bit about how you worked your way through all that thinking in order to be able to follow that new work.
Well, when I first left, I thought I would do it through investigative reporting, but wrongful conviction cases are so complicated and time consuming that, you know, if there's no way this article or something like that would begin to cover the cost of the investigation. So at that point, I decided to get my private investigation license so I could charge for my services.
Okay. And that was the beginning of ACE?
I became licensed later in 1991.
Okay. So you've been a licensed PI since 91. So that's 28 years now? 28 years. Is my math right? 27 years?
27 years.
Right. So not bad for doing it on the fly. And so you began doing a lot of wrongful conviction cases. Anybody coming to you wanting to work getting ready for trial for cases where they're, you know, people's were telling you that their loved ones or their clients were innocent?
Yeah, I started working also with criminal defense attorneys, pre-trial investigations, because it was helpful to also prevent wrongful convictions from occurring.
Sure.
So I still do some of that, but the bulk of my work, which I do nationally, is the wrongful conviction investigations, quite often with the various innocence projects around the country.
Okay. And according to the information that you sent me, there's been at least 20 wrongful conviction cases where you've helped free 20 wrongfully convicted individuals.
Correct.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I've got one that we're getting very close on in West Virginia that could, we hope, will clear four men who were convicted of murder, basically with no physical evidence and only a coerced confession. And I was asked to look into the case back in 2014. Of course, the money, the family didn't begin to have the money to, you know, pay for me and for attorneys to try to get it reversed. So I went to one of the Innocence Projects I work with and had just worked on a case with them and asked them if they would consider taking it. And they looked at it and agreed to take it. And we requested some DNA testing. And it came back, the DNA testing came back identifying the DNA of an Ohio sex offender, not any of the four men who were convicted in the case. So we're now in the process of litigating that, and the prosecutor's reinvestigating the case. And but I've continued to investigate the case and found out all kinds of pretty shocking information about this Ohio sex offender. Also interviewed him and caught him in a number of lies, some of which were needless, but he's one of these people who just has a problem with the truth in general.
Yeah, it would tell you that the sky is black, and when you know it's beautiful blue, right? And this was a case that is recent, and we can't go into particulars on it because it's still being litigated. But that's an amazing story that the family or the group that they came to you, and you were able to convince the Innocence Project people to take a look at it, and then that got the legal machinery moving, which allowed you the opportunity to do the investigation in a more directed way to go about trying to find out the truth. So that's amazing. I mean, that one of the things I talked to you about last week when we were getting ready for this was that you published Presumed Guilty back in 1991. And this is well before the DNA explosion of innocence or exonerations. This is well before different innocence projects, came into being. You were really on the front end of all this. Was it a very lonely road that you were on back then in 91?
Yeah, it really was. At that time, I was about the only private investigator in the country specializing in it. The Innocence Project was founded a year later in 1992, but there had been an Innocence Project before that called Centurion Ministries, based in Princeton, New Jersey, that had freed several people before that. But in some of those cases got some attention, but it wasn't until the DNA explosion occurred that people started really paying attention.
That's true. And now it's even gotten more mainstream, for lack of a better word, after, I guess, the podcast Serial with Making of a Murderer and then other things that were, you know, coming in. It was a perfect storm of activity taking place in the last, you know, five, six years of media exposure and other things coming around. So now it's much more out in the forefront and people can grasp the idea of a wrongful conviction a little bit better now. But I still think a lot of people are just don't understand it, that they can't wrap their head around the fact that sometimes the boys and girls in blue get it wrong, and that not only do they get it wrong, but they sometimes make it wrong. And it is really important for us to understand that it's a there's a check and balance going on here. And now that we're starting to see more and more wrongful conviction exonerations, we're starting to see why some of these cases started out bad and what the reasons why they got to where a conviction occurred when it should have never even been brought to court. I mean, is that a fair statement for me to get on the soapbox with for a second there?
Yeah, it happens far more frequently than most people realize. In my book, Presumed Guilty, I quoted an Ohio State University study that estimated that conservatively 8,000 people a year were wrongly convicted of felonies. That later was revised to up to 12,000 a year are wrongly convicted of felonies. And, you know, there's actually now a database that compiles exoneration cases since 1989.
Okay.
And it's over 2,000.
Right.
That have been exonerated. But, you know, that's 2,000 out of how many?
Mm-hmm.
Tens of thousands who were wrongly convicted.
And not only that, but there's how many thousands of people have accepted plea agreements because they realized that if they had gone to trial with the attorney that they had or with the evidence stacked against them, that they would pay the trial penalty. That would mean that they would be facing a much harsher sentence than the plea that was on the table. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. It's become a growing concern because the percentage of plea deals continues to go up. Used to be about 90% of cases ended up with a plea. Now it's, you know, I think it's more over 95% are now resolved with a plea. And many of those people are actually innocent, but they may be looking at a life sentence or a death sentence. So they take the plea to avoid that. Or just to get out of jail as quickly as they can, rather than going to trial. And if you do go to trial, there's what they call the trial penalty.
Yes.
Because you had the audacity to challenge the indictment and take it to trial. If you lose, you're going to pay a big price.
Sure. You just wasted the court's time, right?
Yeah. You know, judges don't like it and prosecutors don't like it that you actually went to trial.
Yeah.
They want to indict you and have you cop a plea and then everybody's happy.
Right.
And if you challenge that, you're going to probably pay a price.
No, I know. And to that point, I had a case a little while ago where the defendant was looking at 60 years in jail with the attorney that he had, and the deal was proffered for 38 years. Now, the guy didn't have a real large education, but he could do the math between 60 and 38. And he knew if he went to trial with that attorney, he would lose and he'd get 60 years. So by taking a plea, even though he was innocent and was later proved to be wrongfully convicted and exonerated, then the difference was what? 22 years. So he understood the difference between a 60-year sentence, a 38-year sentence, and he pled guilty to a crime that he had nothing to do with. Yeah, he was completely nothing to do. So I don't like to use the word innocent because that carries a lot of connotations to it. But let's just say that there was no basis whatsoever for his arrest. Is that another way of saying the same thing? So anyhow, but you know, Marty, to your discussion about a lot of wrongful conviction exonerations, you also were able to help a few people that were originally sentenced to death be able to walk out of jail. What was that like?
That was very fulfilling. They were no longer on death row at the time because their convictions their sentence, their death sentence was overturned, but they spent several years on death row, and they remained in prison for 23 years before we were able to get them out. And so that was a very fulfilling thing. Unfortunately, another aspect of this whole issue is what happens to people who are exonerated and released. And quite often after the cameras are turned off and the crowds go away, they are left to deal with life on the outside, which has totally changed since when they went in.
Right.
And some people handle that better than others. And there are efforts now to try to help get these people counseling and get them established on the outside so they have a fighting chance. In that particular case, one of the two also came out, and this is not uncommon, with major health issues. And he had had diabetes for years that was not treated in the correctional system. So when he got out, he had an enlarged heart, and his diabetes was very hard to control. And he died about 3 years after he was released.
So being imprisoned and not having adequate health care for a crime he didn't commit basically became a death sentence.
Yeah. So he had a death sentence anyway.
Huh. That is just heartbreaking to think about it. And it goes on all the time, right? It's just not, people that are exonerated. There's a lot of people that are in prison that have health issues that are not getting treated properly, and their situations worsen to the point where it becomes a death sentence. And many times for cases that they went to jail for that didn't require any sort of, they weren't sentenced to death. They were sentenced to a time in the penitentiary, X number of years, but because of their poor medical treatment, it became a death sentence. So yeah, not exactly a nice way to go through one's life, for sure. So anyhow, I just wanted to touch base a little bit more with you on what became through the years as you began to do more and more of these wrongful conviction cases, the type of best practices that you saw that would work, and why some cases were more successful than others based upon utilizing good investigative technique. Can you talk about that a little bit with me, Marty?
Yes, I just got off the phone with a journalist friend who had just written a book about a possible wrongful conviction in Cincinnati, which had been a high-profile case featured on 48 Hours and Dateline and other shows. And she's written a book about it, which I helped her with and gave her advice on, and actually did some investigating for her. One thing we were discussing is getting more records and how to get them, because quite often a whole lot of things are in writing somewhere, and the system has sometimes a good way to hide that. And so you have to keep asking and plotting away to make sure you get anything. And next to DNA, and I've only had so far one exoneration that involved DNA.
Mm-hmm.
The next best thing to look for is exculpatory documents that were withheld. And which is a Brady rule violation. So I'm always looking for documents that were withheld, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, just in the flow of documents. So you have to go through all the documents with a fine tooth comb and look at every document with a lot of curiosity. For example, I worked on a case, and we eventually got the defendant out of prison, who was a police officer, and he was convicted of arranging the murder of his wife. And the supposed killer, who was deceased, but his brother, who was a career criminal, in an effort to strike a deal when he was in jail, he accused this cop of arranging with his brother to have his wife killed. And
his the brother's wife or the cop's wife?
The cop's wife.
Okay.
And so we didn't have any kind of confession from the actual killer or killers, but the brother of one of them, because the brother who was actually supposedly involved committed suicide. So we had nobody directly involved in the case. We had the word of a career criminal that his brother had told him this before he died. And he said that, and actually what it was, the goal was not to kill the wife. That was something that happened in the course of what the police officer want, is that he paid to have these guys burglarize his house to scare his wife. They lived on a horse farm outside of town where he was a police officer, and he wanted to move into the city so he would be eligible to become police chief. So he supposedly hired these guys to burglarize his house to scare his wife into thinking, well, yeah, maybe moving into town's a good idea. And the only thing is, there was no requirement in the city charter that the police chief had to live in the city.
Huh.
But, you know, that kind of got overlooked in the process. And supposedly, she walked in on him, and one thing led to another, and she ended up being raped and murdered.
Oh, Jesus.
And this guy went on to say, well, you know, we've had other people pay us to burglarize their house for insurance purposes, etc. And kind of bizarre.
Okay.
To think that people would invite criminals into their home. And at one point he said they had done something similar in a town nearby. And the thousands of documents turned over, there was one page of a burglary report that had been totally overlooked by the defense attorneys. And when I first looked at it, I thought, what the heck is this doing in here? It had no mention of burglary for hire or anything, just the original incident report.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided to contact those people, and they had quite a story to tell. And they had been approached by the sheriff's office that was investigating, had already charged this cop with murder. And they wanted them, the husband and father of that household, to admit that he paid these guys to come in and burglarize his house to persuade his wife to sell the farm. And everybody in the family said, this is absolutely absurd. You know, first of all, he loved the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But they kept pushing and pushing them, and they took statements from them. And it ended up being very dangerous because in that case, their daughter walked in on the burglary. And she ran, and they actually shot at her.
Jeez.
So they just said, you know, this is absurd. So they all gave statements, and they threatened to charge the father if he didn't agree to testify against the defendant. And he refused. He said, I'm not going to admit to something I didn't do, and I'm not going to try to implicate another man and help prove him guilty when he's probably innocent.
Huh.
So he refused. And what I discovered, you know, they told me they had given statements and everything. Well, there were no such statements in the file.
Hmm.
They turned over thousands and thousands of pages, but they never turned over any statements from these people. So we finally got them through discovery, and they clearly had been withheld. So based on the Brady Rule violation, the conviction was eventually overturned, although the police officer had to go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court fighting the prosecutor who didn't want to relent. And eventually the Supreme Court declined to hear the case, so the appeals court ruling stood, and he was released from prison.
After how many years?
In that case, 10. So,
and any idea who actually did it?
Oh, I think these people probably did do it. They were heavily involved in burglarizing homes, particularly outside of the city. And I think they did it, but I don't think it had anything to do with the police officer paying them to burglarize his home.
Got it. Wow.
But that story helped get this guy a sweet deal for the charges that he was arrested on.
So
you've got to pay attention to documents.
Sure.
And if something doesn't make sense, start asking questions. Mm. You know, well, what is this? Where did this come from? And of course, the prosecutor argued that they had disclosed this because they had turned over the incident report, but not any of the statements or any statement by the snitch who told them that they had been paid to burglarize the house. The only thing that was there was an incident report about a burglary.
Jeez.
So you have to take a look at every document and if it arouses any suspicion at all, to follow up on it.
Sure.
And the same can be with names. You may read in a statement that somebody's name is mentioned just in passing, and the investigators never pursued it, and the defense attorneys never pursued it. But somebody later can say, well, I wonder what that person has to say. And in some cases, that person may have a lot to say.
Sure.
That shoots a lot of holes in the case.
Absolutely.
So, you know, documents are very important. And next to DNA, the best way to get a conviction overturned is a Brady rule violation.
And that's showing prosecutorial misconduct and the failure to turn over documents that had defense counsel had that at the time of the trial might have been able to do some investigation and possibly introduce evidence to show reasonable doubt. Do I understand that right?
Correct.
Okay. So I know I just you just told me a story, but our listeners are really interested in hearing what some of Marty's other stories are. I mean, after all, the podcast is titled My Favorite Detective Stories. So do you have a favorite detective story that you'd like to share with me, Marty?
Well, I have a couple, two of which ended up on Unsolved Mysteries back in the mid-90s. And one was a murder with no body in the hills of West Virginia that was very intriguing. And we eventually got the defendant out. Ironically, he was also a cop.
Wow.
Cops won't hesitate to wrongly convict another cop, usually from a rival police department.
That's funny.
And there have been a lot of cops who have been wrongly convicted.
Wow. That's a wrinkle.
So just because you have a badge doesn't mean that you won't get implicated and improperly prosecuted.
Okay.
So, but the one that I probably has more interest than any other, as a matter of fact, I just got a call from a Canadian production company that wants to do a story on the case.
Okay.
And it wasn't a homicide. It was starting in the mid-70s, the county just to the south of Columbus, Pickaway County, was flooded with these mysterious, anonymously written, bizarrely printed letters making all kinds of accusations against public officials, against individuals who were cheating allegedly or killed somebody allegedly. And they had an awkward style about them in addition to the block printing, just the way the person wrote. And eventually in the early 80s, the letter started to focus on a school bus driver and the superintendent. And the letters accused the superintendent of having an affair with this school bus driver who was married. They were both married. And these ultimately ended up also having signs posted around the county, most of them rather profane, saying that the bus driver's daughter performed sex acts on the superintendent
and really
pretty nasty stuff. And
so not only did it involve the school bus driver, allegedly, but now her daughter, right?
Yeah, and supposedly her husband got a call and somebody told him who the letter writer was. And so he told his wife he was going to go out and confront this alleged letter writer. And he had an accident on the way and was killed. And interestingly, and with no explanation, his gun had fired a shot. And, no explanation for that at all. So that added to the mystery, you know, was he killed? What happened to him? But anyway, eventually it culminated in this bus driver was driving down a country road, and she saw a sign attached to a post along the side of the road that said something derogatory about what her daughter had done with the superintendent. So, of course, she was angry. She got out of the bus. She had finished her route, so there were no students on. She was headed back to the school, and she ripped the sign down. And when she ripped the sign down, there was a gun attached to the post that misfired.
Oh, my.
And that was, the gun had the serial number partially filed off, but not completely. And they traced that gun to a man who lived in Columbus, whose wife was the sister of this bus driver's husband who died in the accident. So, and he had just gone through a bitter divorce, and his ex-wife went to the sheriff and told him that he was the letter writer and this had been going on for years, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of it didn't make sense because this man never lived in Pickaway County, and whoever was writing these letters knew a whole lot of people in Pickaway County, and he had never lived there. And he had a good job and worked about 50 hours a week. So how he would, and he had three or four kids, and how he would have the time to write all these really bizarre letters about all kinds of people that it would be hard to understand how he would even know about them.
Sure.
But because of the gun being traced to him, and I obtained statements later that he had from a neighbor that he had told the neighbor a couple weeks before all this happened that his gun was missing, and he felt that his son had taken it when he came to pick up things when he was moving out of the house because he was very attached to the mother. And, you know, after that, he noticed that his gun was missing. And that was the gun that ended up as part of this booby trap.
And did the son live in Pickaway County?
Yeah. And so what happened is he, although he was never charged with writing the letters, they were used extensively during the trial to link him to the letters. And they had a bogus handwriting analysis done that said he was the writer of these letters. And proper procedures were not done. And, of course, handwriting analysis is a highly suspect type of evidence that's been greatly disputed over the years and is considered more of an art than a science.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically this guy got railroaded and was convicted of attempted murder and sentenced, I think, to 20 years in prison. So everyone thought, well, that would be the end of these letters. But it wasn't. The letters continued. And they would continue the threats, and they would make fun of the sheriff for convicting an innocent man. And the sheriff insisted that this guy in prison was somehow still writing these letters.
Oh.
And he was put in isolation. Whenever somebody would visit, he would be strip searched before and after the visit. So they did not allow him to have a pen or pencil. He passed a polygraph exam in which he denied that he was writing letters, but the letters continued. And for some time afterward, for about 10 years after he was convicted. And so I developed some theories about who was behind this, but the most telling thing to me, again, was getting documents. And it took me quite a while to get the sheriff's department to turn over the investigative file. And in the investigative file was a statement by another bus driver who had driven along the same road about 15 minutes before the second bus driver came upon the sign. And she gave a statement that she had, when she was driving along that road, she saw a man standing beside a vehicle, and he had something in the back of the vehicle, and he was standing by that very post, and he turned away from her when she drove by, but she gave a description, and it did not match the man who was convicted. And the vehicle that the man had did not match the vehicle, any vehicle that this man had access to. But it did; those things did match the description of somebody else who had an axe to grind and may have wanted to frame the defendant.
Hmm.
The defense never saw that document. And so that, when I revealed that and I investigated this case in a transition period, from journalist to private investigator, I published an investigative magazine called The Ohio Observer. And I wrote a story about this mysterious case and revealed this document for the first time. And that garnished me some threats from anonymous callers who were very upset that I mentioned that particular kind of vehicle. And so somebody was upset by it. And eventually, a short time after that, the man came up for parole, and the parole board told him, based on everything they had seen, that they didn't think he committed this crime to begin with, so they put him out on parole early. He did attempt to file a post-conviction petition, but he was broke and got a pretty poor attorney who really did a horrible job. And the attorney never even attempted to talk to me about the documents and the other things I had uncovered. So the petition was quickly dismissed. But that I got that on Unsolved Mysteries in 1994, and I still get several inquiries a year, all these years later, because there are discussion boards with all these armchair
detectives.
And unbeknownst to me at first, this became a highly discussed case, and everybody's got their theory, and it's so. This is still over, 35 years since this man was convicted.
Wow.
It's still a hot topic among the internet sleuths.
Okay.
And that spills over into, I've had magazines contact me, want to do a story about it. I've had several other TV shows want to do a story about it. Writers who want to do a book about it. And to tell you how far this has gone, a few weeks ago, I got an email from a middle school student here in Ohio who told me that they have to have a research project every year at her school, and her research project was going to be this case.
Wow.
So here's a middle school student, maybe 12 years old, interested in this 35-year-old case. So it's very intriguing. And, I have some theories about who did it, and one of which was a bus driver, another bus driver who had a crush on this woman, and he had tried to get her involved in an affair, and she had rejected him. And then he found out she was starting an affair with the superintendent instead, and he was very angry about that, supposedly. And he was a very odd person in addition, and he was a longtime resident of that county. He eventually got charged with molesting a 12-year-old girl.
Oh, geez.
And disappeared before he could be arrested. And he was actually featured on America's Most Wanted. But it turned out that he actually, shortly after he fled, he had committed suicide in another state, and they didn't find out about this until many years later when they were still looking for him and he was long dead.
Okay.
So he's obviously a pretty disturbed man. And so he's a pretty likely suspect.
Okay.
There are a couple others. But there's just not enough evidence. And I actually, back in 2012, I was approached by an out-of-state attorney who had grown up in that area, and he was very intrigued by this whole thing when he was a kid. So he wanted to try to get the defendant, Paul Freshour, back in court. So I agreed to start another round of investigating on the case. And then at that time, I was approached by a local TV station that wanted to do an update on the case because it still fascinated so many people in the area as well as around the country. And so they wanted me to ask Paul if he would agree to an interview. And he said, no. He said, unless we come up with some new evidence that'll help get me in court, I just don't want to talk about it publicly. So the reporter convinced me to consent to an interview in his stead, which I did. And the TV show ran. And when I looked at it on their website, there was a footnote saying they had just been told that he had died earlier that day. So I called the family, and they were still in shock and hadn't called me yet, but he had died of a heart attack early that day.
That is Paul Freshour.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So that kind of, I thought, would be the end of the case, but it still fascinates people. And just very mysterious. The letters were really, really bizarre. And they had a very stilted language about them and this weird block printing. And ironically, one thing I like to talk about is that the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle,
right,
was always swamped with requests. And people actually wrote to Sherlock Holmes. They thought he actually was alive. And from all over the world, asking him to investigate cases. Well, a couple of the letters that came in, and they come in by the thousands every year, a couple of the letters intrigued Arthur Conan Doyle. So he decided to investigate them and cleared two innocent people. But in one of the cases, the man had been convicted of crimes related to a series of mysterious, anonymously written letters back in rural England, in the late 1890s, early 1900s. So these kind of mysterious letters have occurred, and actually possibly inspired by these letters in Pickaway County, somebody started writing anonymous letters in an adjacent county to the south, making all kinds of accusations against members of the school board. And this went on for years, and they couldn't figure out who was sending them. And they finally got a break, and it turned out to be a former member of the school board who had an agenda, and he was actually convicted of making threats and I think got a short prison sentence.
So he was a copycat to the Pickaway letters.
It seems that way.
Huh, how about that?
And who was writing the letters after Paul Freshour went to prison? It's hard to say. But
yeah,
they just went on and made all kinds of accusations. They finally spilled over into Franklin County and started making accusations in a suburb of Columbus, Grove City, and about people doing improper things there. So it was just really bizarre.
Wow.
And I suspect there was more than one writer.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Copycats who carried on with the letters long after they thought they would end.
Wow.
So pretty bizarre stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's great. That's a great story, and I certainly appreciate it, and I know our listeners will appreciate it as well. How can people reach you, Marty, if they want to get in touch with you?
Well, my website is aceofohio.com, one word, and that also has my phone number and additional information.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you my phone number if you want.
Not now, but that's okay.
Okay.
And then you're also a contributing editor, I understand, with the Wrongful Convictions blog?
Yeah, that I contributed to that. That's kind of been taken over by a Facebook page, but we still occasionally publish articles on that blog. So, funny how technology changes. You know, it went from blogs, and now the big thing is to have a Facebook page.
Sure. Yeah. Well, social media. Okay.
Yep.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, Marty. I thank you very much, and I look forward to talking to you again sometime. I thank you again for all the time you've given me here as well.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our next guest is returning for an encore performance. Pat McGehee is a former police officer, homicide detective, and is a supreme storyteller. If you like good cop stories, you don't want to miss this one. Our circle around the campfire continues to grow by leaps and bounds. I thank you for telling your friends and leaving reviews on your favorite podcast app. FYI, each episode takes around 5 hours to research, interview, edit, format, and produce, as well as share. Then there are the expenses to air the shows. I love these podcasts, and your ongoing support is appreciated. You can support the show for less than a couple coffees a month at patreon.com/myfavoritedetectivestories. Patreon is spelled patreon.com/myfavoritedetectivestories, all one word. And you will receive all the stories and just the stories from my guests. But wait, there is more. Each guest has given me a second story exclusively for Patreon subscribers. Help me bring to you my favorite detective stories.